All right, good morning, everybody. My name is Millie Schamberger. I am the Business Programs Coordinator for the American Home Brewers Association. Really excited to be here. Just want to welcome you all to Providence. We're so excited to be hanging out with the home brewers on the east side of the country, and we can't believe it has been 19 years since we've been in New England. So 28 years since New England.
That's why we can't believe 19.
So I'm going to take a moment and introduce my co-presenters today. I have Jen Blair, who is the executive director of the Craft Maltsters Guild. That's a nonprofit trade association that's dedicated to promoting the tradition of craft malting. She has recently, within the last year, been elected to be the industry subcommittee chair. She has been All Grain Brewing for 5 years, and her favorite beer to brew and drink is barley wine. And then we have Bart Watson, who you've seen up here before. He's the chief economist for the Brewers Association. That means he's overseeing statistical and economic work for us. He is a certified Cicerone. He got his PhD from California, Berkeley. And in addition to his dissertation, he completed a comprehensive survey on brew pubs in the Bay Area. So a couple housekeeping things. As you all know, turn off your phones or put them on vibrate. We will be doing a Q&A at the end of the presentation today, so I do ask that you come up here and speak into the microphone as we are recording these seminars, and we want people to be able to hear what you have to say. And lastly, I'm going to have Jen come up and talk about a couple other housekeeping things, and then we'll go ahead and get things started.
All right, thank you. Good morning, everybody. We are just going to go over, if you've been in one of these before, you're familiar with the antitrust guidelines for our meetings. We won't be discussing pricing practices, forecasts of price increases or decreases, any kind of specific credit terms, discounts, rebates, freight allowances, or any kind of selection, rejection, boycott, refusal to deal with, or termination of any suppliers or customers. So now that we've gone over that, I'll tell you a little bit about the industry subcommittee. As Millie said, I had the honor of being chosen to be the chair this year, and super excited to be up here with all of you and to meet all of you. This is my first time up here as part of the industry subcommittee, so I'm really looking forward to meeting everybody. So our committee was actually formed during the NHC in 2010, and our goals are to foster better communication between the AHA and industry entities, as well as provide resources, assistance, and guidance to the AHA based on concerns brought forward by said members of the homebrewing industry. So a few of the activities we've done over the past year is help generate content for the industry newsletter, Talking Shop, review and develop questions for the annual industry survey and the semi-annual revenue survey, and help generate participation in the surveys. That's going to be a little bit about what Millie's going to be talking about today. Engage with and contribute to our industry forum. Explore methods, campaigns, and ways to promote the hobby and activity of homebrewing on a national level. Provide insights and feedback from industry to the AHA and to the AHA Governing Committee on trends in the hobby and the community. And so with that being said, I'm going to hand it back over to Millie to talk about the shop survey.
All right. Many of you are familiar. We do a shop survey every year. I am the business programs coordinator, so the primary role of my job is in service of shops and conducting this industry research. So I did send you all an email before the conference. How many of you have read the 2019 survey report? Nice. So just begin with the purpose of the report. The first section of this presentation today is designed to look at the results of the survey and focus on some of the key themes, and that's going to set us up for discussion points later in the presentation. So let's go ahead and look at the results. So this year we did have a decline in response rate. We had 154 responses, and that represents, 134 responses. That represents 154 retail locations in 37 states. That's down 19% from the 2018 survey where we had 189 respondents. This response rate actually represents 22% of the 685 shops in the country. And of those, 82% said that their primary source of income comes from home beverage making supplies. So we'll look at length of time in business, as that affects a lot of this data. So the average number of years in business is 9.5 years, approximately. When we look at the median number of years in business, it's a little bit smaller, and that's due to just a subset of shops that have been open a little while longer that are driving that average down. So if we look at a breakout of newer shops, we have 31% have been open 3 years or less, and approximately 10% have been open less than a year. All right, so let's take a look at the opening and closure rate for homebrew supply shops in the United States. So we ask here, how has the number of home and beer wine retailers in your area changed in the last year? So in this graph, we take a longitudinal view of what that looks like. So if you look at the yellow trend line in 2019, that indicates that 52% of respondents perceived a no change in the number of retailers in their area. If you look at the green trend line, you see that 10% of respondents perceived an increase in the amount of retailers in their area. And if you look at the orange trend line here, you see that 38% of respondents perceive a decrease in the amount of retailers in their area. So what's interesting here is that this is the first time that we've actually, in 5 years, that we've seen more perceived closings than openings. But we actually do our own tracking internally of shops. And when we look at our numbers in... When you look at our numbers, we actually saw less closings this year than last year. So in 2018, we saw 47 closings, and in 2017, we saw 94 closings. So it's interesting that you guys as respondents are perceiving more, but yet we aren't seeing that same trend with our own internal tracking. So now we're going to look at revenue. So we've seen this before. One of the reasons that we're seeing an increase in the amount of closures is because revenue is down comparatively. With that said, in 2018, on average, we look at gross revenue for all of the retailers is flat when you consider a closure rate of about 1% from the end of Q3 2018 to the beginning of 2019. One thing that we are going to be doing differently this year with the survey is that we've always done quarterly surveys and one annual survey. In an effort to not over-survey all of you and hopefully increase our response rate, we're hoping that we're doing a semi-annual survey just on revenue, and then our annual comprehensive survey is going to just give us a better picture and hopefully a better response rate as well. So every year we do break out this data into a funnel of different types of retailers. So if you look at the change in gross revenue from 2017 to 2018, we saw that all shops saw a 1% increase in gross revenue. If you narrow that down to shops that are selling homebrew supplies as their primary source of income, we see an increase of 1.2% in gross revenue. And if you narrow that down even further to shops that are selling homebrew supplies as their primary source of income that aren't doing 70% or more of their business online, we start to see a decline of 3%. And lastly, we narrow it down even further to homebrew shops that are selling homebrew supplies as their primary source of income that are not doing more than 70% of their business online, that have been open for 5 or more years, and we start to see a decline of about 5.3%. Okay. So now we look at the quantity of respondents that are reporting double-digit growth figures. And in this survey, we saw shops that grew more than 10%, we saw a decrease in the amount of shops that grew more than 10% compared to 25% in 2017. Approximately 10% of those respondents saw growth of 20% or more, which is down about 17% from 2017. And 58% of shops in general experience a decline. So what we look at when we're looking at this growth is a couple of things. Some of the ones that are doing better have been newer. They're deploying new marketing techniques and other types of alternative revenue streams. Perhaps their store footprint is a little bit different. And there are two things that we think about when we're looking at that, one of which is online sales. And we all know this, that it's the elephant in the room that online and e-commerce is becoming more and more popular. And it's almost key to have some component within your business to diversify and make sure that you're hitting markets that you aren't. And the other thing that we look at with these businesses is just a different entry into the hobby. So a lot less homebrewers are entering through traditional avenues. So most folks are just going straight to all grain brewing, and we see that in our survey data as well when we look at malt extract sales. So the brew in a bag, the brewing appliances, the small batches are becoming increasingly more popular, and we have to figure out a way as retailers to market that to people so that homebrewing is more compelling. So let's look at beginner beer kit sales. So how many of you perceive that there's probably fewer beginner equipment sales in your shop? Yeah. So over the past 12 months, we asked, have your sales increased, decreased, or stayed the same? If you look at 2019 here, the yellow trend line indicates that 42% of respondents perceive a decrease in the amount of beginner beer kit sales. If you look at the green line here, you see that 24% of respondents perceived no change in the beginner beer kit sales. And if you look at the orange line here, you see that 34% of respondents perceived an increase in the amount of beer kit sales. So on average, those are down comparatively to other years. But in general, I would encourage you to incorporate more educational classes. Make all grain brewing not as intimidating, and as we see a shift later in the presentation to a younger brewing audience, that'll be increasingly important to keep homebrew relevant. And then we also take a look at beginner wine kit sales. So we see similar trends with the wine kit sales. The yellow line represents that 35% of respondents perceived a decrease in wine sales. The green line represents that 39% perceived that there was no change in their wine kit sales. And the orange line indicates that they perceived an increase, a 25% increase in wine kit sales. So one reason that the wine kit sales could be down much more comparatively to the beer sales is just, in general, wine is a more expensive purchase. When you look at the average purchase of wine supplies, that averages out to approximately $69 per purchase. But when you take a look at beer supplies, we're looking at more like approximately $44 per purchase. So we asked you guys about customer spending. When we look at customer spending over the past few years, it appeared that the amount of respondents perceiving an increase in customer spending had flattened out. Last year and this year's survey are indicating a little bit otherwise. The blue bar here for the 2019 survey indicates that 37% of respondents perceived an increase in customer spending compared to 34% of respondents in 2018 and 25% of respondents in 2017. So this could mean a couple of things. Maybe you have some customers that have all of their kits and all of their equipment, and they are really just coming in to up-level their brewing techniques. And in a lot of ways, that's an opportunity because either we're trying to find ways to get the new home brewer into the shop, but if you already have this customer base, looking for unique and creative ways to, like I said, up-level and take them to new new types of brewing is certainly a way to continue to get that customer keep that customer spending up. All right, so customer frequency. So how many of you get asked like a million questions when you check into a hotel? Yeah. And this is so important because they're collecting data on you. We all know that people are following us around the internet, and it's really important to collect data. So when we look at customer frequency, relative to previous years, it's actually up at about an average of 8.9 visits per customer. And and the rate of customer visits continue to level off, and it's actually at the same frequency it was, you can see, in 2015. So this might indicate that this downward trend is sticking around, but it also correlates nicely with the fact that we're seeing a perceived increase in customer spending as well. So let's talk about age groups. So when we ask this question, it's a perception of essentially what you think the most common age group is in your shop. We don't expect that you're tracking the age of your customers, but so we're seeing a continued shift towards a younger demographic in brewing beer. You can see that the early 20s age group here, the 25 years old to 21 years old, presumably, you can see that the early 20s age group has increased by 1% since 2017, or effectively doubled. 30 to 39 does continue to hold the most representative group in the beer brewing community, and this trend just demonstrates that how important it is for us to continue to think about where our marketing dollars are going and how we're promoting home brewing to the audiences that are younger. So whether that means increasing your social media ad buys or looking for ways to incorporate more digital advertising into your homebrew shop budget. Those are just a few ways that you can be sure that you're hitting the younger age group. So we asked the same question with wine. Again, I just want to mention that it is a perception of age groups. It doesn't actually represent data that you guys have given us, but here we see that wine is generally represented by an older group, and that the over 60 age group is not even represented in the beer common age groups, but here you see that it has a presence, and it has for several years before this. All right, so we ask this question every year. It's what areas of operation do you struggle with most in running your homebrew supply shop? We did introduce a new option this year, which was e-commerce. And for the past several years, marketing has been the main pain point for shops in terms of areas of operation. And not surprisingly, however, when we introduced the e-commerce option as an option here, it actually came in second, then followed by inventory management. So one really great way to make sure that you can enter into the online space is inventory management and understanding pricing. And we do have two seminars this week. One is this morning with Tim Brady right after this on the psychology of pricing. And then we're also going to have an inventory management seminar this week. And just I want to make a point, too, that I know the majority of the apprehension into getting into the online space might be related to technical challenges, but I've had some conversations with shops here and just, back in the office that some shops are only introducing small amounts of items into the online space just to get acclimated with how it works and how fulfillment and inventory management works when you're doing a brick and mortar and you're doing an e-commerce shop. So don't think that it's out of your reach. You can start really small and build from there. And I've seen that work really successfully for a lot of shops. All right, and then this was a new question that we asked this year in our ongoing effort to better understand the demographic and socioeconomic and ethnic makeup of Homebrew as a whole, but also just the our membership. So, again, this is another question about the perception of your customer. So we asked in this question, estimate the percentage of customers that identify with an ethnicity other than white or Caucasian. So you guys, or the respondents of the survey, indicated that on average they're perceiving that about 16% of their clientele are identifying with an ethnicity other than white or Caucasian. And you'll see here that the bigger pieces of this pie, that 32% of respondents perceived that less than 5% of their customers identified with an ethnicity other than white or Caucasian. And then after that, you see that 24% estimated that about 6 to 10% of their customers identify with an ethnicity other than white or Caucasian. So again, this is an opportunity. I've had some great conversations with shops that are getting outside of their neighborhood. They're setting up booths in places that they normally wouldn't. They're having all women brew days and days to elevate the beginner home brewer so they're not as intimidated. So again, I think, just like I said with the younger generation, that branching out and finding some new ways to tap into a more diverse clientele could reap a lot of benefits for you guys. And then here's a summary of what we just talked about. So shop closures are up and openings are down, which results in the overall number of shops being down. Sales of beginner homebrew kits are down due to a greater acceptance of the non-traditional beginner kits. Customer spending and frequency is perceived to be up over last year. And again, homebrewing is competing not only just with other hobbies and interests, but any other consumer-driven avenue. So we're not just competing for their time and their hobbies. We're competing for anything else that they might be interested in buying. So finding ways to keep the hobby relevant, I can't emphasize that enough. We are seeing a shift towards a younger brewing demographic. And lastly, retailers that have been open longer without some sort of e-commerce component are seeing some single-digit declines. So this is where we're going to learn how to combat some of these challenges. This morning, you all know it's 9 a.m. We're doing the homebrew state of the industry. Shortly following this, we're going to have Tim Brady, who's going to be doing The Price is Right, How Consumers Perceive Pricing Changes, at 10:15 a.m. Tomorrow at 9 a.m. in the same place, inventory management, part science, part art. Tomorrow at 10:15 a.m., we're having a seminar on creating and organizing a homebrew event. And on Saturday morning, we have product diversity in your shop, how to successfully go beyond beer and winemaking equipment ingredients at 9 a.m. And then at 10:15 a.m., we'll have a distributor panel where you guys will have an opportunity to talk to, do a Q&A with distributors from BSG Handcraft, Country Malt Group Homebrew, Brewmaster Wholesale, and LD Carlson. So, and I wanted to just make a quick note that I apologize that we did have a last-minute change with the 10:15 a.m. seminar on Saturday due to some extenuating circumstances that speaker couldn't make it, but I do think that you guys will see a lot of value in having some conversations with your distributors. And another thing I also want to point out is that the Convention Center has changed the name of this space from West Lobby to Sabin Place, so let's just consider those synonymous for the rest of the week. And then I have a couple other things I wanted to talk to you guys about before I hand it over to Bart. So in 2018, the AHA instituted our first ever diversity inclusion subcommittee. We put together a plan with tactics and goals, and we intend to present those to our members as we progress. We're working towards not only better and understanding the member makeup, but we're also exploring how that can benefit you guys and how you can reach new markets. And part of that came from Dr. J. Nicole Jackson Beckham. She's the Brewers Association Diversity Ambassador. She's going to have a talk on tomorrow, Friday, at 3:15 p.m., and it's Relax, Don't Worry, Have a Home Brew, and Then Start a Revolution. And one of the new benefits to member shops is our Diversity and Inclusion Best Practices Manual. It's a 5-part series that just essentially helps you gain a better understanding of how you can start the conversation about diversity in your shop and assess your efforts to see if it's been successful. And lastly, we have our Brewers Association Independent Supporter Seal. So one thing to keep in mind with this younger age demographic that's getting into brewing is that this group and this generation they're incredibly conscious consumers. So in today's economy, when consumer consciousness is at an all-time high, a lot more purchasing decisions are driven by the story behind the business. So what's your stance on environmental issues? How are you owned? Do your practices resonate with that of the target that you're trying to reach? So one way that you can show your support for independent craft is by adopting the independent supporter seal. I'll be sending out an email about that in the next week. So that is at supportindependentbeer.com, and your customers can know that you guys are supporters of the craft beer industry. And without further ado, I'm going to hand it over to Bart.
Thanks, Millie, and thanks to the AHA for having me. So Millie covered the state of homebrew shop sales and some of those trends super well. And what I'm going to try to do is take one step up and look at some of the bigger social, demographic, retail, economic trends that might be affecting you now, but also might be things to keep in mind for the shop 5 or 10 years in the future. So this is a slide I've used before, but I like to bring it back because I think it's an interesting one and a powerful one. It's one of my favorite graphs I've ever created. This is Google searches for how to homebrew correlated against white male unemployment. And you can see that they work really well together. This always gets a chuckle, but I think there's something very serious that underlies this that is a lesson for some of the trends that Millie talked about, which is that homebrewing for a lot of people, especially when they're getting into it, is a very time-intensive hobby, and it's something that if you have a full-time job or multiple full-time jobs, as many people do in this economy, that you don't have time for. And so I think what we're seeing partly right now in some of the things like beginner kits, entry into the hobby, is that in a country where we're getting pretty close to full employment, and economists will argue about how close we are, that we're not going to see a lot of entry until we see this unemployment rate go back up, because people simply just don't have the time, they're working hard. You see in lots of other, just because they're working doesn't mean that ends are getting met for all people. But this is one thing to keep in mind, is that the state of the economy and some of these other variables that we really can't control can have really dramatic effects on what you're selling, how you're selling it. And so if the economy slows back down, we'll get to test this. But I would be a strong better on the fact that we'll see more people start entering in again. We'll see those entrants. So I don't think this is a great correlate for overall sales, but I think it's a good correlate for people coming into the hobby, and that we might see those beginner beer kits start to pick back up as people say, all right, now I've suddenly got a hole of 40 hours a week, and I can only job search 10 or 20 of those. So maybe I'll pick up homebrewing. I've heard that's a great hobby. Moving on to demographics, let's see if this animation works. Maybe? No? We should have tested it. Play? It's not going to work for you. Well, this was supposed to animate from 2010 to 2018, and Gary, maybe you'll get to see me act it out now. But what it was going to show is two things. First, we've got these two big generations that are moving through the U.S. economy right now. So that first bump on the right, that's the baby boomers. The second big peak on the left, that's the millennials. And these are driving a lot of the trends in the consumer economy right now. They're also both aging and moving through two of the biggest transitions that people ever move through in life. So the baby boomers are beginning to retire, which is transitioning everything about how they live their lives, how they make and spend money. And the millennials are starting to move from the carefree 20s into family formation and a real other dramatic change in life. I think this is going to shift a lot of things in the economy. We're already starting to see this. But, you know, this is, you know, I would make a couple of points here relative to the homebrew industry. First, unfortunately, right now, the homebrew industry is drawing from that trough. It's drawing from 30s and 40s, which are the smallest. And in the U.S., no generation is small. You know, every age group, every single age bar has 3 to 4 million people in the U.S. That left axis is how many, you know, people are in each single age cohort. So even the lowest ones have, you know, 3.5 million people in them. But, you know, we are drawing from our typical demographic range from the smallest percentage of the population. So I think there's huge opportunities, A, to either expand the age groups into those bigger bases, or B, you know, in the future, as the millennials age into their 30s and 40s, you know, if we can get them to adopt homebrewing in the same way that we've seen from previous generations, there are huge opportunities there. Here's some of that demographic information. This is done in a different way than that shop survey. So Millie, you know, was showing the data on, you know, what shops perceive as their core customers. These are from demographic surveys that the AHA has gone out and done. Skews a little bit older than those surveys. Generally, we still see the 30s and 40s as kind of the big period. You know, one difference here is we see the 40s indexed a little bit higher. These are indices. So 100 would be that group homebrews at the same percentage as their percentage in the population. So if they're 15% of the population, then they are 15% of the homebrewers. As that index goes up, it means there's more of them. As the index goes down, there's fewer of them. So right now, you know, 30s and 40s are the groups that are overrepresented in homebrewing relative to their percentages in the population. And based on this data, it suggests that we're seeing a cohort of homebrewers really move from their 30s and 40s, and we're not getting new people in their 30s. So that contrasts a little bit with the data that we saw in the shop survey. You know, I don't know if it's cause for alarm or not, but it's something to keep in mind that we need to keep that pipeline of new people coming into homebrewing, or at some point they all start aging out. And you can see homebrewing really drops off a cliff at 50, at least in the demographic data. We saw that in the shop survey as well. So how can we extend homebrewing, you know, thinking about, you know, lower ABV beers or ways to keep people engaged as they move out of their 40s? I think that entry and exit are going to be things that to continue to grow the hobby and keep your shop healthy. You know, we've had kind of this golden era where a lot of people entered in, you know, again, a lot of it around that, you know, economic downturn. And then we haven't necessarily transitioned to a model where we keep that pipeline going. All right. Moving on to, you know, what do people spend their money on? Which I think is going to be relevant. This is entertainment spending per capita converted into real prices by age. So we can again see that the 30s and the 40s are the period of time in life when people spend the most on entertainment. It's that sweet spot where you still have energy to go out and do stuff, and you actually have some money in your pocket because you've finally gotten a job that pays you something. You know, it's much lower for under 25 because those people are poor in general. And then it decreases into the 50s and 60s, both because, you know, people maybe are a little bit more set in their habits, but also, you know, that's typically we do see incomes start to trail off, people move on to fixed incomes, et cetera. I don't have 65 plus, that would be even lower. But you can see that really hasn't changed in recent years. So we can't ascribe any of homebrewing's woes to people spending less on entertainment. You know, they may have more options out in the world now. Entertainment options proliferate. But generally, these groups spend just about the same amount of money year over year. You can see it went down a little bit during the Great Recession, and we've seen it come back up a little bit. But these groups are spending the same amount. One thing to watch for the future is what does their spending look like on beverage alcohol? Now, homebrewing and spending on beverage alcohol, you know, aren't exactly the same thing. Some people are homebrewing because they don't want to spend out in the market on beverage alcohol. I think that's a fairly low percentage of the homebrewing population. Most people who are homebrewing are also going out and trying new, you know, breweries or wineries, meaderies, et cetera. But I think the thing I wanted to highlight here is that while we've seen those 30s and 40s groups stay pretty consistent in their spending on beverage alcohol, this is, again, over time in real prices, so it controls for inflation, we've seen a really sharp drop in that under 25 group. Now, there's a lot of analysis out there about why. You know, does this next generation, Gen Z, just not drink? Are they burdened with a lot of other costs in the economy? So when you break out this consumer expenditure data, you see that their cost of housing is going up, that they're moving to more expensive places, and so they're spending more on things like rent. You know, student debt levels are really, really high for this generation, so, you know, they're spending more money on that. So maybe this is not that they don't want to drink, but that they don't have the money to drink. But when we go back to that idea that we need to create a pipeline, this is something that I think people should be keeping in mind, that the next generation isn't guaranteed to to drink or act anything like current generations. And there are starting to be some signs that they are not engaging with the beverage alcohol industry broadly, anything like the millennials even. I mean, this is a different generation, the millennials. So I wanted to highlight that. And you are the first people ever to see this data. This is from a survey we do with Nielsen every year. It's focused on the craft beer industry. It's our consumer insights panel. But we ask 1,000 nationally representative consumers a whole bunch of different things. And this year we added a new question about mindful drinking. So drinking, you know, outside of kind of, you know, what we normally think about. So things like health and wellness, fitness goals. And I went through, and this is a small sample size, so take with some grains of salt, because when you get down to this 21 to 24 age group, we're talking about, I think it's only about 70 people out of our 1,000-person nationally representative sample. So, you know, the error variance is going to be really high. But the numbers are kind of eye-popping. So if you look down the fifth one, you know, and the question was something like, what do you factor in, you know, if you're thinking about drinking, you know, what characteristics do you factor in? And this was much broader than just like flavor or taste. These are these value characteristics. That is non-alcoholic was 30% for 21 to 24. I mean, you know, this is a dramatic sea shift. And again, you know, 30% of 70 people, I mean, we're talking about 20 people saying this. So, you know, don't overreact too much. Well, you know, we'll want to see this replicated year over year. But they're higher on a lot of these things. That is low calorie, 47%. You know, when I was 24, I could eat and drink whatever the hell I wanted and, you know, not worry about it. The fact that, you know, half of them say that they are looking for beverage alcohol options that are low calorie, I mean, that's, again, that's a very different way than young people entering into beverage alcohol have typically thought about the world. And you see this pretty consistently across all these data points. Organic, aligns with my fitness goals, health-centric ingredients. I mean, the list goes on and on. So, you know, are you going to dramatically reformulate your shop around what some 24-year-old kids who don't really know what they want in life say on a survey? Probably not. But I think these are things to start keeping in mind as you think about how am I going to attract new people into my shop? You know, what am I doing to do things that are different than the current homebrew model? And how am I thinking about some of these trends in larger beverage alcohol and consumer products to try to attract some of these new people in? You know, maybe we're going to do a, you know, a gluten-free brew day. Maybe we're going to do a, and, you know, obviously there are homebrewing products that already accomplish that as well, you know, cider and things like that. So, you know, you may be able to lean into a few of these things and in the process attract a few new customers. All right. I wanted to close with some changes in retail. These are well known. Millie covered some of them, but the data is somewhat eye-popping, so I think it's worth laying out. This is just quarterly retail sales data. It's broken into e-commerce, brick and mortar, and then that yellow line is the percentage of total. So we've moved from, you know, around 2000, where this was about 1% of total retail sales in the U.S., to currently where e-commerce is now 10% of all retail sales in the U.S. This varies a lot if you look at it by sector, but, you know, the code that homebrewing would fall under is pretty similar to these overall trends. And if you look at this curve, you can see that it's not linear, it's accelerating. We're seeing this pick up. You know, this is what we would call, you know, an S-curve in economics, so we're expecting that at some point it'll start to level off. But right now we're still in that rapid ramp-up phase where this trend is probably going to accelerate in the next few years. So you're going to see e-commerce gain greater percentage share than it has in the past. Here's putting it in real dollars. So this is controlling, for inflation. You can see that if we break brick and mortar and e-commerce into their real dollar components, that brick and mortar sales have actually gone down on a per capita basis. So the average person in real spending spends less at physical stores than they did a decade ago. Or it's a little bit more than a decade ago, but in 2005 when it's at its peak. E-commerce is more than made up for that, so the average person spends a little bit more than they did. We as a country have gotten slightly wealthier, makes sense. But we've seen, you know, that spending has gone down about almost $250 from brick and mortar, and has gone up almost $300 in e-commerce. So we're seeing this, you know, shift almost one-to-one out of brick and mortar on a per-person basis into e-commerce. And I don't have any slides on it, but, you know, if 40% of you are, you know, are struggling with e-commerce, get ready for mobile commerce, which I think is a separate branch of e-commerce. So not just shopping on desktop platforms, but on your phone. I'm sure many of you have been time-wasting or shopping on your phone while I'm talking. We are now all addicted to our phones. And that this is a platform separate from e-commerce, is coming and is going to be more important. So this is probably the holiday season this year when mobile is going to pass desktop for sales. Mobile is going to sell more than desktop this holiday season. It was about 40-45% of all holiday sales last year went through mobile. This year, it's probably going to be a majority is going to be mobile. And if you look at the younger generations, way higher. So, you know, they're already a majority of their e-commerce purchases are on mobile. So if you're thinking about, you know, kind of, as Millie said, starting small with that e-commerce platform, it might be time to start thinking small about a mobile version of that. And how are you going to make sure that most of the internet time for the next generation is going to be via a very small device that they carry around with them all the time, which is, at some level is good for you, right? Anytime they're thinking about homebrewing, then they can buy. But that's the next wave of this, and it's going to be a bigger and bigger chunk of these purchases. And so just thinking e-commerce is probably not enough going forward. You know, one nice thing about e-commerce, too, is that we see it as a much steadier business. So this is growth by quarter, again, controlled in prices. The yellow is brick and mortar, and the blue is e-commerce. E-commerce has been steadily growing quarter after quarter for decades. Brick and mortar is all over the frickin' place based on all sorts of things, you know, time of year, weather, pricing, state of the economy, that, you know, brick and mortar has become a much more inconsistent business. And you see this across all sorts of sectors, you know, and you can think of lots of reasons for this. I mean, you know, weather's one that's often given, but that, you know, people don't like going to the store when it's pouring down rain. E-commerce, you can do anytime from your couch as you also watch another TV show and your kids run around screaming. So, you know, you can see it pretty consistently from the data. E-commerce is growing steadily but surely, and brick and mortar is going to be one that, you know, when you're thinking about future demand planning, is going to be a little bit more inconsistent. So these aren't things to freak out about, but they're things to see the trends, understand, and start to factor them in your business long term. I'm going to close there. I didn't cover anything about craft beer or brewing, but I would be more than happy to talk about the craft beer industry at great extent in the Q&A if anyone has questions. Thanks.
All right. Awesome. Thank you, Bart. I'm going to completely shift gears now. For better or worse, I don't have any graphs for you guys. But we are going to talk a little bit about affecting positive change in our homebrewing community through working with legislature and administrative agencies. So show of hands, how many people have contacted a federal, state senator, administrative agency? All right, perfect. Thank you, guys. that more good news, it's a lot easier than you think, and it's not quite as intimidating as I think a lot of people tend to view it as being, and it also doesn't have to be as time-consuming. So we're going to go back to high school just really quick with a brief civics lesson, because what you'll hear me say over and over throughout this is you need to make it easy for your legislators, for your administrative agencies to give you what you want. So to do that, you need to understand what they do. So most of us are familiar, United States government, three branches of government. The legislative makes the laws, the executive carries out the laws, and the judicial evaluates the laws. So we're not really going to be talking about the judicial branch today, just really the legislative and the executive. And so when you're thinking about which branch you're contacting, it's important to keep in mind senators, representatives under the legislative branch, they're elected, right? You're their constituent. Administrators, commissioners, et cetera, they're appointed or hired. They're not elected by the general population, which I point out because you'll hear me refer a lot in North Carolina this year. We had some proposed homebrew rules that when they first came out, it was kind of like if you asked me to write a manual about like how to break down a chicken. I've been a vegetarian all of my life, so I can kind of get there, but I don't really know. And one of the first things that happened when I was encouraging my homebrew club to reach out to our state ABC was someone BCC'd me on an email saying, I strongly urge you not to support this bill. And it was going to an agency, and it wasn't a bill, and it wasn't a rule, or it was a rule. And so it's important to keep your audience in mind, because you want to make it easy for them to give you what you want. At the very least, you want to make it hard for them to disregard you. So when we're talking about contacting your local government, keep in mind who your audience is going to be and structure that accordingly.
So if you're not sure, sometimes I have to go look this up. These are two really great websites for finding out who your state and federal legislators are, and also finding out who your state regulatory agency contacts are. So I like to just throw that up because I think it's a very convenient way. With my work with the Guild, I do things in a lot of states, so I need to be able to see who the representatives are in different kinds of states. So now that we've figured out who we're talking to, who we're going to contact, we have to do the really boring nitty-gritty stuff, which is we actually have to read the law and understand what it is that it's saying. So before I joined the Guild, I actually worked as an attorney, so I've gotten a little bit used to legalese, but it's still boring, right? It's confusing. Don't get frustrated by that. Be patient. A lot of times I find just kind of skipping to the actual language, skipping over your definitions and all of the rules of law that it's pulling from, and just getting into the weeds is very, very far easier than just kind of going through the definitions and like, am I a home brewer or whatever. Make sure that you're asking questions of the agency or the office. Do that for clarification and also to understand motivation. And this is another really important aspect that came up this year in North Carolina, where one of the proposed rules was to eliminate homebrew competitions in the production area of commercial breweries. And somebody on our working group just reached out and said, hey, what's the policy behind that? And they said, well, we don't want homebrew getting mixed up in the fermenters and going into the commercial product and getting sold to the public. Again, like I can tell you how to break down a chicken, but you're going to be like, what? So knowing that was actually really important, because when we went into the hearing, we had pictures another member had taken at a homebrew competition in the production area of a commercial brewery that we had blown up. And we said, you can see from the pictures, it's closed systems. If anybody got anything into a fermenter, it's just an act of trespass. Like, that's, you have to intentionally do that. So asking questions like that, we wouldn't have known that otherwise. And when the proposed rules became permanent, they had taken that out, and they allowed for homebrew competitions to take place as long as it wasn't in production, like actively in production at the time, which, fine, that's what we do anyway. But if we hadn't have asked, we wouldn't have known that. The other things to note from the outset are very important is when the comment period ends and who the contact is. So the good news, too, is that they make that pretty easy for you. You can see on here on the first page what I've circled in red just notes that there's going to be a public hearing. It tells us where, when, and then right on the second page, they lay out this is who you contact for the comments. This is when the comment period ends. So if you're trying to get people to get involved, to contact, make sure that you're making note of when the deadline is to do that and repeat that to people often. So now that we've read it, we know who we're contacting, we've asked our questions, it's time to actually communicate. Avoid form letters and petitions. I didn't want to like shout it at you in all caps this early in the morning, but don't do that. And it's hard to resist that urge. As soon as you ask people to contact a state agency, a legislator, they're immediately going to say, do you have a form letter? Do you have a petition I can sign? And, 1 million signatures on a change.org petition doesn't have anything compared to one very thoughtfully written comment about, I am your constituent, I am a small business owner, or I am a brewer. This is how this is going to affect me. So avoid that. Avoid the form letters and petitions. Again, make it easy for them to give you what you want. Clearly identify your page numbers, the line numbers. And the good news with that is that they've usually already done that for you. So you can say, page 2, line 23, this specific sentence, this is what I would like to see changed or altered. And again, make it clear and unambiguous. Don't give them a reason to disregard what you're saying. And then you can just tell your story. Explain how the proposed legislation or law impacts you, and then suggest an alternative with an explanation. When we're contacting our legislators and our administrative agencies about homebrew, in most cases, we are the subject matter experts. So it's very easy to say, you know, you can't actually get homebrew into the air, into the fermenter. So how about we all agree that we just won't do it when the brewery is actually in active production? So then the next step is mobilizing your community, getting other people involved. Emphasize communications must be polite. I think people a lot of times kind of get in their head, you know, like politicians and fat cats and bureaucrats, and they're going to tell them what's what. That makes it hard for them to want to help you. So emphasize again, it needs to be polite. You'll see in the example I've got on the next slide, I just, you know, reminded people, hey, we've got an opportunity as homebrewers to educate this administrative agency on what homebrew competitions look like, on what homebrew meetings look like. And this isn't something that's being done to us maliciously, so keep that in mind when you're contacting people. Again, concise and specific, a thoughtfully written email letter, that can be a few sentences. It doesn't have to be something very, very long. And then explain your call to action in a clear way that makes it accessible and possible, even if you haven't contacted somebody before. Make it as easy for your community to get involved as you possibly can. So post guides or suggestions, not forms, not copy and paste. Do that on your website and your social media. And then do the same thing. Empower them to tell their own stories. And with our proposed homebrew laws in North Carolina, when we were talking to the club, it was just as easy as saying, hey, raise your hand if you've ever dropped off your homebrew at a drop-off site. And if these proposed rules go into effect, you won't be able to do that anymore. So what does that mean for you? Well, it means I'm probably not going to drive it all the way across the state to enter, so I'm not going to enter. And, you know, things like that. It's just that easy. Just identify how that's going to affect you and tell that story. Once more, explain the role of the office. Go back to the civics lesson from the beginning. And then the preferred process. So they'll usually tell you if they want. It's usually emails. That's just easier now. Nobody wants to talk to each other on the phone, so it's usually just going to be email. But if they prefer letters or phone calls, just let them know that. So make it as easy as you can for your community to be able to get involved and kind of remove any of those roadblocks for somebody who says, well, I don't even know who to contact. I don't know what to say. Give them that information. So this is a rules guide that I put together for the North Carolina homebrew community. I mean, this really just took about an hour of my time. It's not as time intensive as you necessarily think it's going to be, but you can see at the top, I say, here's who to send the emails to. The subject line. They very specifically said, if you're going to comment, make sure this is in the subject line. So again, make sure people know that. Make it easy for them to give you what you want and not just disregard you because you didn't have the correct subject line. A link to what the actual rules are so people can go and read it themselves. And then the call to action. Email Walter Reagan by Monday, November 8th, about your concerns. And you can see there I remind them in two different places to be courteous. And again, it's not something that's malicious. It's not something that's being done to us. We're the subject matter experts. We need to offer our knowledge to our local government. And then just went through was here are some examples. You know, if you're where I am in Charlotte is very close to South Carolina. A lot of people from South Carolina not only enter North Carolina beer competitions, but they go judge in them, which means they spend money in the state, which means they stay in hotels, they eat at the restaurants. That's valid too. And again, just providing some examples, reminding them don't copy and paste these. And then you can see on the second page, just give them some useful stats. The AHA is a fantastic resource for giving you all of the kinds of this information to throw into your email when you're at the public hearing. Remind them about how much tax revenue they're likely going to lose if they enact these rules or laws. And again, make it easy for them to give you what you want. And that's my last time I will repeat that, but please keep that in mind when you are contacting your legislators, your regulatory agencies. It's really not as intimidating or time-consuming as I think a lot of us think that it might be. So with that, I'm going to hand it back over to Millie.
All All right, so I'm going to quickly go through the AHA resources that we have for you guys so we have time for Q&A, and unfortunately my links went live here, so it's a little difficult to see. But so as a member shop within the American Homebrewers Association, we have a host of resources, one of which is our state beer media list. This is a media list that's curated specifically for beer media. We do this every year, so it's not like you're getting the same list for your state year over year. Again, when we're talking about that younger generation, putting together press releases and getting content made for you from media agencies is one really great way to have something that's shareable within your social outlets, and then boom, all of a sudden you're reaching this younger demographic through social by content that you created with local media. Seminar recordings, again, these are available to all of you that attend the industry track, but we also have them dating back several years. So while some of the content may seem outdated, it's a lot of it is very evergreen and can be continue to be relevant going forward. I say this every year, but the AHA Industry Forum is an underutilized resource, and I'd love to see more engagement on it. It's a great way for you guys to keep the dialogue going beyond HomebrewCon. Similarly, we introduced the Industry Subcommittee Forum Board this year. This is your avenue to have communication with our industry subcommittee. Go Brew Yourself is our pamphlet that we have put together that is a few steps into entering into the hobby. It points them to AHA.org, where they can see a more in-depth explanation of how to get into it, whether it's the brewing appliance or extract or all grain. Homebrewersassociation.org. We have tons of content, and all of that can be used to share with your customers, but also to share within your social outlets and your newsletters to engage customers to be more excited about the hobby. Shop membership does come with 5 individual AHA memberships. Again, shops that do really well are shops that are investing in educating their staff and making sure that their staff is up to date on the newest home brewing trends. So access to AHA content is one way to make sure that they are educated on that. And the last two are new options. I already talked a little bit about those, but the Diversity Best Practices Manual is one, and our Independent Beer Supporter Seal is another one to show your support to different markets. And with that, I'm going to open it up for questions.
Before my question, I think the Saturday 10:15, that's the one that got changed, right?
Yes.
The website still lists the search engine optimization thing. So
okay.
You guys could update that.
I will talk to our team about that.
So my question is, for the online sales and the survey, I'd be curious to see if there's a breakdown of people doing sales through their own website versus through like Amazon and eBay and, you know, third-party retailers like that.
Yeah, we actually talked about this with, we had 2 industry subcommittee calls before HomebrewCon, and one of the things we did talk about specifically was including a question in next year's survey that addresses that exact thing that you're talking about. So,
Good morning. I would say on the internet commerce, I think why the dollar volume is higher would be equipment, where they're not buying it through the local homebrew store, but actually I'll pick on SS Tech or other large, large purchases of $2,000, $3,000, $4,000 worth of purchases would definitely increase why that's such a higher number versus going through a local homebrew store.
Yeah, I could definitely see that as well, and I think, too, just the ease of use of ordering things online, like Bart was saying, just having your phone in your hand all the time and being able to just click and proceed to checkout certainly would incline people to spend more money. I mean, I think I'm not the only one who's been down an online shopping rabbit hole. So,
I'd jump in and say, too, that, you know, I studied retail trade for my dissertation, and every new generation of retail trade, people always at the beginning say, oh, this is only going to be 4, and they write in something, and then you just see it spread. People said it about big box retailers. Oh, people are only going to buy, you know, big appliances there, and they're not going to buy other stuff. And now everyone buys everything at Walmart. And people have said that, you know, said the same thing about e-commerce early on. I mean, Amazon was a bookstore, and people thought, oh, maybe that's as far as it'll go. So anything that they are buying on e-commerce now, it's going to spread. They're going to buy more stuff on e-commerce. And so that might be in the data now, but in the future, it's going to spread. I guarantee it.
So have you done any research on how cannabis sales is affecting the newer generation?
I don't know about homebrew specific, but in beverage alcohol, I think there's no strong evidence that it's affecting sales. When you look at legal states, medical states, and illegal states, beer trends were actually the best in totally legal states on per capita terms and were the worst in illegal states last year. Looking at states where we can look before and after legalization, we don't see huge changes in trend. Now, in the long run, this could look totally different, particularly as product variety goes up. So we're just starting to see cannabis beverages, for instance, which really haven't existed in the past. So this might shift in the future. But most of the analysis I've seen suggests that this hasn't been a huge shift because, A, there was already a big market before, so we can pretend that legalization is the first time that people use cannabis, but that's not true. And B, in most of the states where we've seen legalization, we've seen pretty significant price drops, which actually means that people, even if they're buying a little bit more cannabis, may have more money in their pockets. And so, you know, we saw that total entertainment spending and total beverage alcohol spending stay pretty constant. You know, people do have constraints on their budget, and if the price drops in one product, they may have more money in the other one. So we may be seeing offsetting effects. Last thing to say is that people, I think, conflate beverage alcohol occasions and cannabis occasions, and there's overlap. But, you know, there's companies that are tracking this, and there's evidence that about half of cannabis occasions are totally different than beverage alcohol, that there's a lot of medicinal use. The fastest-growing cannabis segment of the population is 55-plus. You know, people who are using it for health and wellness or, you know, perceived health and wellness, at least. So I think in the long run, there's probably got to be effects of another $100 billion market coming online that has overlaps with beverage alcohol, but in the short term, we haven't seen any effect on sales. And let me say, any net effect. I think there's lots of little sub-effects, so lots of people who are consuming less, but other people are consuming more, and those are offsetting.
One thing that I would like to see is maybe on the social media side of things, which age demographic is more prevalent in which age group. That would help me market or gear towards other to the demographic I'm looking for.
Great. Yeah, absolutely. We actually, this year at the AHA, we've had a social media manager within the Brewers Association, but we actually have our first dedicated social media manager for the American Home Brewers Association. So I could certainly work with her to get some information to you guys that would help you with that.
Good morning. I have a couple questions. Do we have any idea, I know it's easier on the pro brewer side, but do we have some idea of how much homebrew has been made in 2018 compared to 2017?
Like batches?
Barrels, gallons, you tell me.
I don't have that data readily available. We did do a 2017 survey, and it tracked the amount of batches brewed, and I could certainly try to provide some of that to you. If you want to grab a business card, we could talk about that.
Yeah, that would be really interesting. Thank you. Also, any idea in between, like, you know, we saw beginner beer kits declining. What about, you know, medium to advanced kits? I would assume, like, the all-grain kits, we're probably seeing an increase, but
I don't know that we're necessarily, we aren't asking a question about all grain in the survey specifically. We do ask about the perception of malt extract sales, and those have, malt extract has been down for several years. I think on average respondents this year said that they were down about 44%. So it could be interesting to see what that, like if they're not spending their money on the malt extract sales, what other places are they spending their money?
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you. And we'll take one more question.
I know you noticed that there's a decrease in size of the customer base as age goes up. And we've noticed in our shop that when people have kids is when they stop. And I'm wondering if we've done any research into how we can get people who are having young families to still spend time homebrewing.
Well, one thing I'll say about that is, I mean, that you're definitely right. I mean, we see it even in our own office with people that are having kids. You know, it's a time constraint, right? If you don't necessarily have 5 or 6 hours to put aside when you have an infant or a toddler to homebrew. So I would like to explore that more, that's for sure. Do you have anything to add, Bart?
We touched on this briefly in a State of the Industry a few years back. And, you know, one of the pieces of advice was businesses that think about customers with kids are going to do better with customers with kids. So what have you done in your shop to make it so that if somebody comes in with a three-year-old, it's easy for them to shop while that three-year-old is there? And if the answer is nothing, then it's no surprise that the parent with a three-year-old doesn't come in. And, you know, as a parent who has a 10-month-old myself, you very quickly recognize the shops where it's okay to bring that child and the ones where it's not. And parents are going to react accordingly. So, you know, if that's a demographic that you're seeing a lot of in your area and you're seeing those people drop off, you know, I mean, it might be as simple as, you know, having a staff member who's, you know, been basically trained, you know, hang out with a kid or creating a little play area. I'm seeing that more at breweries now. They have a dedicated play area. This is, you know, this is not something you would have ever thought of in a drinking establishment. But breweries are recognizing this and they're shifting. And guess what? You see a lot of parents drinking with their kids in places where those kids are welcome.
Lollipops. In case you didn't hear that, lollipops is one way to start. So, well, I want to thank everybody. I'll be here all week, and I'm happy to answer any questions offline, but we need to get ready for the next seminar. So I appreciate you all coming, and I'll take that feedback, and hopefully we'll have some more data for next year.